But everyone is in the water. I gesture toward the crowd. Someone could get hurt.
If a snake comes upon the women, they will simply push it away.
Ravi considers the children, and his mouth turns down.
The children, I fear, may consider the snake a toy and use it for their amusement.
Shouldn't they kill it? My voice rises a notch. It's probably poisonous.
Ah, but are we not the ones who are a bother to them?
He points his cane at the river.
Who is to say to whom this land belongs? The snake would argue it is its home that we have disturbed. Its poison may be its only defense.
As if on cue, the shriek of a child shatters the silence. A young boy holds up a small snake like a prized possession before flinging it to his friends. I hate snakes, and I don't want them near me. I wrap my arms around myself as a shiver courses down my spine.
So, you claim your rights are superior?
Yes, I do. I give him an evil eye and dare him to disagree.
Then I recommend we move away from the water and into town. I worry we may come across a snake, and you will find your superiority lacking as you run for your life.
Loud Bollywood music and laughter welcome Ravi and me back into the village. There's a large gathering of young men in jeans and shirts, and women dressed in colorful knee-length skirts and blouses. A hush falls over the crowd as a young man in an embroidered red wedding top and cream pants rides into the village, seated atop a baby elephant. What's going on? I ask. The men take the rider and carry him atop their shoulders toward a table near a tent. The women link their arms and form a wall, preventing him from reaching a young woman sitting at the table.
It's the henna ceremony, Ravi says. That man,
Ravi points to the man who was just on the elephant,
is the groom. The girl at the table is the bride.
The groom makes a mad rush toward the bride, but the women hold their ground, blocking his attempt to reach his betrothed. There's laughing and teasing every time he tries and fails.
It's a sacred part of the wedding. Though the wedding is a physical act, the spiritual aspects of it are most celebrated.
On my wedding day, I wore traditional white, and we were married on the beach. I never thought to have an Indian wedding. Why is it sacred?
They paint our hands with henna, intricate designs that symbolize the depth of love the husband will feel for her after marriage.
Seated next to the bride, her friends paint her hands and feet. The groom makes another playful run to reach her, while his friends stand by, laughing.
The artist will subtly blend their names into the design. On the wedding night, the groom can't consummate the wedding until he finds them.
Ravi smiles.
There are many tales of grooms searching all night.
The bride's girlfriends begin to sing songs in Hindi, and soon the men join in. They seem oblivious to the heat, even as sweat lines the back of their clothes. What are the women singing about? Though I can decipher some of the words, I still can't make sense of the entire song.
They are teasing the bride about her husband and future in-laws. They are saying he will get so fat that one day he will fall asleep on top of her and she will be stuck. They are cautioning her not to cook too well.
A large crowd starts to form. Parents join their children as the festivities continue. Who are the rest of the people?
An Indian wedding can be as small as 200 people, or up to 600.
In front of the small campfire, the pujari cuts a coconut and lays fresh flowers and uncooked rice alongside it.
The coconut represents fertility, Ravi explains. The flowers are for beauty, and the rice symbolizes sustenance.
The priest pours melted butter onto the fire to keep it alive. As the sun starts to set, the party intensifies. The music gets louder, and everyone begins to dance. The future bride joins her fiancé. He says something to her, and she throws her head back and laughs. I envy them their happiness. Their life is ahead of them, and their opportunities are limitless. On my own wedding day, I was sure nothing could break us. Pain and heartbreak seemed impossibilities given the amount of joy we shared. My thoughts stray to Amisha and her choices. Watching the couple, I can't help but feel grateful. For as long as Patrick and I were together, I knew true happiness. No matter the despair that followed, I loved him, and I wonder if I always will.
43. 2 days later, I wake up on the anniversary of my first miscarriage. I dress in one of the outfits I bought from the market. I head out, cognizant of each step as I take it, wary of whether I am doing the right thing. At the temple, I slip off my shoes and climb the steps. Namaste. The temple is quiet, with only a few families in attendance. Welcome. The Brahmin accepts my offered plate of fruits and flowers. Thank you. You will have a long and happy life. I appreciate that. I search the faces of the deities. Each one is mesmerizing. Is there something you are seeking? The Brahmin asks. I just came to ask. I pause, searching for the right words. Not ask, maybe get some answers. I try again. That's the goddess Parvati. Yes, and Durga. He gestures toward the statue next to her. Both very powerful forces. I kneel between the two goddess figures that stand together in graceful harmony. Their eyes are the color of crystal lavender, and their hands are painted gold. I shut my eyes and imagine my babies playing, their laughter a balm to the wounds that refuse to heal. I would have shushed their cries with hugs and joined in their laughter. To them, I would have given more of myself than I had ever given before. My grandmother came to this temple, I say to the silent sculptures. I never knew her, but I have no doubt she was stronger than I will ever be. In this moment, I feel younger than my years and even more naive. But I am here to ask you for a child of my own, I whisper. The tears fall, my sadness refusing me a reprieve. I lower my face onto my knees and hide from the Brahmin and from the eyes of the goddesses. I hide from the world and from myself, still uncertain of my place. Jaya! Amit approaches me with trepidation. I quickly wipe my tears. Hours have passed, and the sacred statues are now draped in shadows. Amit, how are you, Beta? I'm fine. He holds a plate full of flowers and fruits. He notices my tear-streaked face. Are you all right? Your great-grandfather says the temples have an abundance of power. I run my hand over my face one last time, hoping to remove all traces of my tears. I may have gotten caught up in it. I wrap an arm around his shoulder. I'm surprised to see you here in the middle of the day. You don't have school? We were let out early today. He glances away. May I ask you something? Of course, anything. I lead us toward the far edge of the temple, where we can have some privacy. Do you believe in miracles? He's hesitant, but seems eager to hear my answer. You seem to be very smart. His face is full of admiration.
First of all, I say, smiling at him, from what your Ravi Dada tells me, I can't hold a candle to you in math. Top of your class, I hear. My compliment earns me a blush across his face. And what I believe doesn't matter, I hedge, not answering his question directly. What matters is whether you do. Do you believe in miracles? Misha, he hesitates, but then after a minute he says, the polio, there is nothing that can be done. He stares at the marble pillars. So, I come here daily with offerings in the hopes that God will heal her. He pauses, his throat convulsing. Then she can run and play like the rest of us. I stare at the boy in front of me. He's a man before he's even crossed the boundaries of childhood. It seems impossible to me that one family, one bloodline, can exhibit so much loyalty. Does your Ravi Dada know? I ask. I would not want him to know of my false hopes. Amit stares into the distance. In America, have you seen prayers answered by miracles? There are miracles every day, I say, although I have never witnessed one, and stopped believing in miracles after my miscarriages. Is that what you want for your sister? Yes, he answers. He motions toward the statues. And there is nothing I can do but pray. That evening, I head to the cafe and, in the phone booth, dial the number I know by heart. My breath catches as the distant ring gets louder. Hello? Patrick's voice carries over the line, sounding the same as the last time we spoke. I realize it's close to midnight, his time. Suddenly feeling foolish, I wonder if he has someone there. Hi, I say, when he says hello again. It's me. The sound of his voice has caught me off guard. When we first started dating, we would talk for hours into the night. Soon enough, his voice became the calm in my storm and the cheerleader for my aspirations. It was when I lost myself in grief that I forgot how much I needed him. Jaya! I hear rustling in the background, and I imagine he's putting his pillows up and leaning against them. I didn't expect you. Is everything all right? Yes, I quickly say. I know it's late. I didn't calculate the time until I'd already dialed. I'm rambling, but I can't stop myself. If Stacy is there, I feel bad. Stacy's not here, Patrick says softly, interrupting me. We haven't seen each other again since I told you about it. Oh. Stunned? I fall silent. I was so sure she was the final break in a marriage that was shattered from grief. Confused, I want to ask him more, but I hold back. The time when I was his confidant is long past. I'm sorry. How are you? His voice falls low, and even in the distance between us, I can feel his confusion. I tried calling you, but the line was disconnected. I heard your voice, but you couldn't hear mine. I called you back, but... My voice drifts off. It feels like lifetimes ago when he called. Then, I had only started learning the story of my grandmother, never imagining where it would lead. You hung up. Because of Stacy, he says in the silence. I don't confirm the answer he already knows. I'm calling to say thank you for being there during the miscarriages, I tell him quickly. Today is the anniversary of the first one. When I hear his intake of breath, I swallow the sob that lodges in my throat and pray to get through this without crying. You tried to be there for me. I couldn't see it then, but now I do. I miss you, he says, shocking me. It's the last thing I expected him to say. I hear him shift the phone from one ear to the other, and I know that he's turning on the lamp next to the bed. I missed you then, too. So much. Unbidden hope blossoms inside me. I miss him in my life. Amisha's story drives home how precious love is. I took our love for granted, and when it became too hard, I stepped away, sure I was stronger standing alone. But loving him was not a burden, nor was it a blessing. It was two people who desperately loved each other while making a life together. With him, I could breathe, and I was happy. I was lost, I whisper. I bring my knees up to my chest and wrap my free arm around them. The grief made everything so dark. I'm sorry I couldn't get you through it, he admits. The pain that has held a tight grip on my heart loosens. I wanted to, but I didn't know how. When my sob finally breaks through, I hear him take a deep breath on the other side, and I know he's fighting his own emotions. Thank you for trying, I tell him. I'm sorry I never told you that. We're married, he says, not seeming to realize his word usage. It was my job. When I don't say anything, he says, I've been reading your blog pieces. They're amazing. I let out a laugh in between my tears. Still have your rose-colored glasses on, huh? I tease. No matter how many drafts I would go through, Patrick always told me my work was great. Good to know. His laugh echoes mine, and then we both fall silent. There's so much I want to tell him, but I don't have the right anymore. He's not my sounding board or my confidant. In walking away from our marriage, I lost my best friend and my love. I miss you, I admit. More than I thought I would. When friends would announce they were getting a divorce, I always wondered how the bond could break so completely that the love was forgotten. When Patrick and I separated, I was so focused on what had torn us apart, I didn't remember what brought us together. Now, a small seed of hope blossoms, but the voice of caution, the one that demands I tread carefully, tells me to take it slow. When are you coming back? He asks into the silence. I don't know. My editor recently sent me some assignments I can do remotely. It feels good to be working, in addition to writing the blog pieces. Being here, I think about Amisha's story and her journey. I believe it's helping me to heal. I'm glad. He pauses, and I wonder if, like me, he's still afraid to let me in. I've been checking in with your parents, he says, surprising me. I asked them not to say anything, he explains before I can complain. I just wanted to make sure you were all right. Patrick, I start, but then stop. I want to censor my words, but they spill out. I wish the miscarriages hadn't happened, I whisper. Caution warns me to keep my thoughts hidden, but I am tired of holding back my feelings. I wanted a family with you so much. I wanted us to be parents. I know, honey. His voice is filled with hurt. More than anything, I wanted that with you too. When my tears make it impossible for me to talk, he stays on the phone and listens to me cry. Across the oceans and countries, he offers me comfort. And for the first time since the pain started, I let him in. 44. I arrive at the orphanage late at night. I had tried to sleep, but thoughts of my conversation with Patrick kept me awake. We talked for hours about memories from the past and the hurt that felt impossible to overcome. I started to tell him pieces of Ravi's story. Though hesitant at first, I was encouraged by his interest. For those hours, it felt like we had never been apart. I climb the steps, feeling foolish for visiting when the children are likely sleeping. I knock once, quietly. If someone doesn't answer immediately, I will return home. Yes? The caregiver I met on my last visit opens the door. Her eyes widen with recognition. Srimati, what are you doing here? She ushers me in. The room is dark, with only a small light flickering in the back room. Though most of the children are asleep, a few are stirring. I'm sorry. I know it's late. I keep my voice low. I wasn't sure what time the children went to sleep, but I thought I would come by. Shrugging, I thrust my hands into the pockets of my capris. See if I could spend some time with them? If the caregiver thinks me odd for the late-night visit, she keeps her thoughts to herself. There are always one or two children who wake up hungry. In the kitchenette, milk is warming in a pan on the stove. Would you like to pour it into the bottles? Of course. I find some clean bottles drying on a napkin. You stay up all night? The woman who usually relieves us at night is ill, so we are taking shifts. The caregiver works efficiently and quickly. Her clothes are streaked with milk and food. She's pulled her hair back into a tight bun, though escaped tendrils hang down the side of her face. I finish filling the bottles just as a child's cry reverberates through the room. When she goes for him, I ask, "May I?" When she nods her approval, I lift the crying child into my arms and feed him the bottle. My back against the wall, I slide down until I'm seated with him in my lap. He draws hungrily from the bottle until it's nearly finished. The child lying next to me scoots closer, seeking warmth in the cool night. My throat thickens with happiness. You do it well. The caregiver feeds another child nearby. He's hungry. He's overlooking my clumsiness for the sake of the food. When the milk is finished, the boy keeps sucking. I gently pull it out of his mouth so he doesn't swallow air. I stroke a finger down his cheek and wipe away beads of milk off his chin. What made you want to do this? Care for these children? I lift the child onto my shoulder and pat him gently. It only takes a few pats before he burps. When his body relaxes in sleep, I lay him gently down. I was raised in an orphanage. She rocks her still crying child, soothing her when the cries get louder. It is what I am meant to do. I get her another bottle. You don't have any of your own? How did you know? I say after a long moment. I want to change the subject, to keep to myself that I tried and failed to be a mother. You hold the children like a new mother. Unsure, but excited, she says. I withdraw into myself as I remember the countless books I read on everything from how to soothe a fussy child to raising a happy one. But no amount of research was the same as caring for an actual baby. Even surrounded by a room full of children, I am still alone. I take a deep breath to calm my nerves before asking, "Do you have any?" "These are my children," she yawns, clearly exhausted. "My own family abandoned me, just like these children's families abandoned them." She scans the room, her face filled with love for her wards. "We only have each other."
"They're lucky to have you."
"On nights like this, I must agree with you."
The woman laughs, even as she tries to stifle another yawn.
"So, what brings you to our door in the middle of the night?"
"I was thinking of the children I don't have, and found myself here," I say, more honest than I meant to be.
"You're looking to adopt one?"
"What?" Though Patrick had mentioned adoption, we never discussed it further. When I had dreamed of a child, it had been one from my womb, an image of either Patrick or myself. Adoption felt like admitting failure, and I wasn't prepared for that.
"No, I never thought about it." "I'm sorry, I misunderstood."
"Are many of them adopted?"
"If it is an auspicious year, then a few are adopted."
The woman calls to an older child, who wakes up whimpering. The little girl runs to her and nestles into her lap.
"They arrive here lonely and leave as a family.
If desperation weren't the only motivation, more people would learn the true joy of bringing home a child."
"What do you mean?"
"Don't all parents dream of having their own child, raising someone who is a reflection of themselves?" she asks.
"The parents who come here accept that their dream has died. They have moved from desperation to resignation. They can't have a child of their own, but their hearts still lie empty. They walk through the door and hold their arms out."
"But the child is neither a reflection nor a continuation of their bloodline."
"True, but in that moment, that child makes them a family, and the parents leave here knowing that being a mother or father is a gift, no matter how it comes about."
She carries the sleeping child back to her place.
"I wish it weren't just the few forced onto the path that learn the reward of giving your heart to a child not born to them."
I waited for a miracle from my body, but it refused me. These children are waiting for their own miracle, for fate to bring them someone to love. I imagine what it would be like if one of them were mine. And suddenly my heart feels lighter and my mind at peace. I stay there, helping, until the sun rises and brings a new day.
Amisha, 45. 9 months and 2 days after her joining with Stephen, Amisha's labor began under the shadows of the new moon. Though she continued to fulfill her duties to her children and the household, she had lost all sense of purpose. The labor was oddly a relief. The pain that ripped through her abdomen offered her a reprieve from the months of numbness. For the few hours that her child struggled to enter the world, Amisha was able to forget her loss. The cry of the child yanked her from her thoughts, and she watched with a thrill as the midwife pulled the blood-soaked body from her womb and cut the cord.
"It is a daughter."
Scooping water from a bucket, the midwife washed away the blood.
"On the night of Amavasya."
In quick steps, she suctioned the mucus from the baby's mouth and then bundled the child in a wool blanket.
"You have been cursed."
It was a well-known superstition. A daughter born on the new moon brought bad luck. Amisha dismissed the woman's claim with a shake of her head. Too exhausted to argue with the woman and eager to see her newborn, Amisha held out her arms for her daughter. She caught her breath as a replica of Stephen stared back at her. She brought the baby close and kissed her with all the longing and love she felt for the child's father.
"You are not a curse, but a gift,"
she whispered into the baby's ear.
she sent a silent call to Stephen.
"Our daughter is here,"
she whispered. She wished, more than anything, that they were sharing this together.
"Thank you for giving her to me,"
she said through her tears. Ravi entered, after getting the midwife's approval. He stood next to the bed and watched the child cry for her mother's milk.
"She is gorgeous."
"She is her father?" Amisha said without a second thought. "We will call her Lena."
Deepak entered, after paying the midwife. Ravi immediately moved away and began to clean. Deepak stared at his daughter as she suckled on Amisha's breast. He barely hid his shock.
"Her skin, it is pale, lighter than the skin of a Brahmin."
"It is a blessing,"
Amisha searched for a plausible answer.
"Your mother once said to me that a child with fair skin is the child of a goddess, given to us for safekeeping."
Deepak continued to stare at the baby, and then glanced at Amisha's face. She waited, anxious, until he finally nodded his acceptance.
"With her complexion, we will have suitors lined up at our door for her hand in marriage."
Lighter skin in India was considered higher status. Finally smiling, Deepak said,
"I'm happy for the dowry I have saved."
"She must go to America."
Amisha summoned her strength to raise her voice.
"Her hand in marriage must be given to a groom in America."
It was the only way she could assuage her guilt for having kept her daughter from a life with her father in England. She had to secure Lena for the opportunities that remained elusive to her. It was Amisha's gift to her, and to the father Lena would never know.
"Amisha!"
Deepak was stunned by her insistence.
"We have many years before it is time to decide. We do not know..."
She held up her hand for silence.
"Deepak, I respect your place and mine. However, this I cannot stay quiet about. Give me your word, now, in front of the child that heaven's keepers have given to us. You will not promise her hand to just anyone. She must go to America."
Amisha knew that Deepak could easily negotiate Lena's hand in marriage without consulting her or their daughter. As was often done over a cigarette or at the temple, a discussion would ensue and hands would be shaken. The husband would proceed home and inform his wife and family that the marriage had been decided and that an exchange of brown sugar would soon take place, signifying an engagement.
"Amisha,"
he started again, staring at the child she was holding.
"Promise me, Deepak."
Amisha pulled the sheet around her daughter, shielding her from Deepak's curious gaze.
"Please."
Finally, he nodded.
"You have my word, Amisha."
"Thank you."
Amisha closed her eyes in peace and finally succumbed to sleep, her newborn close at her side. The weeks after Lena's birth were quiet. At night, the baby suckled at Amisha's breast. Lena's eyes soon changed from light brown to a green hue, the same color as Stephen's. Once, when Amisha caught Deepak staring at them, she scooped her daughter up and left the room. They continued with life, Deepak in his role as a provider and Amisha as a mother and the home's caretaker.
"America?"
Ravi asked one day, months later when they were alone.
"Why there, Srimati?"
"If nothing changes here, then it is a place where she can have a chance to be who she wants," Amisha said, "whoever that may be."
When he still stared at her, uncomprehending, she tried to explain.
"What are you and I in this life? We have no rights. No place to go except where destiny deems worthy."
"Did the lieutenant tell you about it?"
Ravi asked.
"Yes," Amisha admitted.
She still recalled their conversation in exact detail.
In America, she continued, voicing the word Stephen had spoken to her, her bloodline will have choices. Lena will have a voice, Ravi. It is her destiny to be free.
But across the world, Ravi pushed. Your only daughter, so far away.
You watch, Amisha smiled, heady at the thought of her daughter's future.
She will come back, this child.
She kissed the baby's forehead.
What of our lieutenant?
What will you do if he returns? Ravi began to sweep the house. The relentless rain poured day and night, leaving the streets flooded and small puddles in their home.
He won't, Amisha said, her mood darkening. Their goodbye had been forever and certain. Neither a day nor night passed when she didn't wonder where he was and how he was doing. In her heart, she was sure he relived the memories of their time together. She never stopped wondering what they could have been together, given the chance.
Do you think he survived the end of the war?
Ravi wondered. The war was over, and with its end came hope for India's freedom from colonialism.
Yes.
Amisha knew Stephen was still alive. She couldn't imagine living in a world that did not include him. That had been the only thing that saved her. Even if they could not be together, under the conditions of their birth, they were together on Earth. They were waking and sleeping under the same stars and sky. They felt the same heated rays of the sun, and their nights were lit by the same moon.
I would know if he had not.
Yes, Ravi agreed. I was witness to your heartbreak from having loved and lost.
He glanced at Lena and smiled.
And to the birth that gifted you light back into your life.
He headed toward the kitchen to help prepare dinner.
For that reason alone, he has to be.
46. As promised, Amisha still hadn't written again, more than a year after Lena's birth. There were no words left in her to string together, or characters that haunted her dreams at night. The only dreams she had when she slept were of Stephen. The monsoon season had ended, and as expected, the insects arrived after the torrential rain. The puddles and sewers were their breeding ground, and in a country that could not prevent the homeless from dying on street corners, mosquitoes were merely a nuisance. Ravi had set mosquito tents over the floor where they slept, but the bites in the early morning and after sunset could not be helped. The children often scratched them until they bled.
Do you want me to summon the doctor?
Ravi tore an old sari into small pieces to be used as washcloths. Amisha was dragging a bucket of water into the house to give Lena a cool bath because the child had felt feverish to her.
Let us see how she does through the night. She must have gotten a chill because she was coughing this morning.
Amisha swatted at her bare arm.
Ouch!
The water bucket fell out of her hand.
What?
Ravi asked.
A stupid mosquito.
Amisha stomped on the offender when it hit the floor.
Your skin is rising.
Ravi pointed to the small hive on her arm.
Excellent. My due punishment for killing the miserable thing.
Amisha laughed, water sloshing on her feet as they went in. The throbbing began 3 days after the bite. Fever and nausea hit Amisha in the middle of the night. She stumbled toward the back of the house, barely making it outside before she spewed vomit. Her body shook, and her teeth chattered.
Samir,
she cried out. She crawled back into the house.
Samir.
Mama.
Half asleep, he searched for her. He spied her on the ground and ran to help her up.
Mama, what is it?
Please, get Ravi,
she whispered. Samir ran to do her bidding. When the nausea hit again, she barely made it back outside in time, where she vomited bile, and then, when nothing was left, dry heaved.
Shrimati, Ravi cried when he saw her.
His hair was disheveled, and he still wore his night clothes.
What happened?
She began to heave again. Ravi pulled her hair back and ordered Samir to get her water. In seconds, Amisha's oldest was back with a full glass. Ravi held her head carefully upright and tipped the glass into her mouth.
Small sips, he cautioned.
Amisha pushed it away, but Ravi brought it gently back.
You must drink, Shrimati.
She drank half, while the rest dribbled down her chin. He wiped her forehead and chin with his sleeve.
Something is wrong.
Amisha held on to him.
My body feels...
Flashes of pain hit every nerve point in her body. A heavy weight bore down on her head, and her vision danced.
You will be fine, Ravi said, seeming to try to convince them both. As a good mother, you absorbed Lina's illness and doubled your own.
Together with Samir, they carried her into the house, past the other children on the floor. Once she was settled on the bed, Ravi ordered Samir,
We need a doctor, now.
After checking Amisha thoroughly, the doctor poured out a dozen small pills from his bag and handed them to Samir.
It's a virus. Give her one every 4 hours for the fever. How long will she be ill?
Ravi asked from his place against the wall. Amisha lay nearly unconscious on the bed.
It should pass in 1 or 2 days, the doctor said. She needs to stay hydrated. The virus will not harm her, but the loss of fluids will.
Ravi counted the money from inside the cupboard and handed it to Samir, who passed it to the doctor.
Call me if it worsens, the doctor said, smiling at the amount. Any time. Sleep, Beta, Ravi said to Samir after the doctor left. I am here, and in the morning we will telegram your father.
When Samir started to argue, Ravi said,
I will wake you, Beta, if she needs anything.
He laid a hand atop the young man's head in comfort.
Sleep. Shrimati will be disappointed if you miss school tomorrow.
Samir rubbed his worn eyes.
You will wake me.
At Ravi's nod, a smile of relief flitted across his face. He crawled between his two younger brothers, where Amisha normally slept, and pulled them close. To the rhythms of their steady breathing, he finally fell asleep while Ravi kept vigil over Amisha. Deepak arrived 2 days later to find Amisha barely able to sit upright in a chair. Ravi had been continuously feeding her a diet of lemon sherbet. Deepak gripped her shoulder.
Amisha! She is weak,
Ravi cautioned, keeping his voice subservient.
Amisha!
Deepak shook her shoulder. When her eyes fluttered, he sighed in relief. He took the glass of sherbet and forced it against her mouth.
You need to drink,
he said. Liquid dribbled down her chin and onto her lap. Amisha opened her eyes slowly and stared at the two of them.
You've come,
she whispered, seeing Stephen. She took a large swallow of the sherbet and then smiled widely, rejoicing at the intimacy of their actions. There was a heavy pressure in her head, but she pushed against it, trying to hold on to the moment.
I thought I would never see you again. I came as soon as I received the telegram, Deepak said. Have you seen your daughter?
Anxious to show Stephen the beautiful child they had created together, she searched the room for Lina.
Every day, it is the only wish I have, that you could see her.
When she failed to find Lina, she begged Ravi,
Please, get the baby.
She gripped Stephen's hand.
She has your smile. Shrimati.
Ravi forced a smile and raised his voice to drown out hers.
Sab knows how beautiful your daughter is. Right now, however, his concern is for you.
He stepped in front of Amisha and reached for the glass of sherbet.
I will make sure she drinks the rest, Sahib.
What did the doctor say?
Deepak asked. Behind them, Amisha fell back into a slumber.
A virus. He gave medicine for the fever, but assured us she will recover.
Ravi pointed to the pills.
I have been crushing them into the sherbet. Make sure she finishes the sherbet.
Calm replaced the anxiety on his face after he heard the diagnosis.
I will be at the mill. If there is any change, send someone for me.
47. 3 days passed with little change in Amisha. Ravi and Bina cared for the children and the house while Deepak worked in town. On the third evening, he stood in the doorway as Ravi felled Amisha naan and potatoes.
She's eating?
Deepak asked from the doorway.
A little, Ravi said, giving him the good news. It is more than before, so it is good news.
Amisha?
Deepak took a seat next to her on the bed. Though Amisha sat upright, her eyes barely stayed open.
I have something for you,
he said loudly, to get her attention. Circles darkened the area beneath his eyes, and his jaw was tight from strain. Amisha once confided to Ravi that she feared the boys saw Deepak as their favorite uncle rather than a father. Though they had his blood running through their veins and were excited when he was home, he did not know them. Their fears, or what calmed them, remained a mystery. He was ignorant of their aspirations or of their intentions to follow him into the business as he had followed his father. Since his arrival home, however, the boys were turning to their father for guidance. He offered them as much as he could. Amisha finally turned toward him. Her lower lip hung low, and her eyes had trouble focusing. She was skin and bones, having lost nearly 10 pounds. He opened her hand and laid a set of keys in her palm. She stared at them first, and then at Deepak in confusion.
What is this?
She struggled with the words.
The keys to the school.
Deepak met Amisha's shocked gaze. He glanced briefly toward Ravi and then paused, seeming to search for the right words.
I know it was important to you, so I thought you might enjoy it. You purchased the school?
Amisha fingered the keys that Stephen had kept with him daily when the school was open. After the British left, it was shuttered.
How? Vikram said the government had no use for it, and I hoped it would help you.
Deepak shook his head, seeming confused as to why the building had any worth to his wife.
You seemed happy when you were there.
You noticed? Amisha whispered. At Deepak's shrug, she yearned to ask him why he had kept her from it. Those last few weeks, when he had refused to let her continue attending, she was sure she hated her husband.
It mattered to you. I see you now, broken from a virus, and I think I would give anything to have you as you were,
Deepak answered honestly.
When you were at the school.
Amisha fought the tears that threatened. It was the first time that Deepak had told her, in so many words, that he loved her. She had forgotten about him over the span of time during which Stephen occupied her every thought. And now, though they were still strangers, he was trying to do right by her.
Quite an amount of money went toward the acquisition,
Deepak teased in the face of her silence.
It would be wise for us to make no purchases until the children are adults. Thank you,
Amisha finally whispered. She watched him leave and then fell asleep with the keys next to her. It took a few days for Amisha to garner the strength to make the trip. Ravi stayed close to her as they approached the school. 8 days had passed since her illness began. Each new day sapped her of even more energy, leaving her weaker. Amisha slowly walked up the steps of the school that had changed her life forever. With shaking hands, she inserted the key into the lock. She had not set foot in the building since Stephen left. She had believed it to be her past, and though it was only blocks from her home, she'd assumed she and the school were destined never to be a part of each other's life again. Now, she owned it, free to roam the empty halls and visit its garden without fear of reprisal or questions. This was hers, a gift from the husband she had betrayed. Her thoughts were lost in an earlier time as she and Ravi entered. She looked into the barren classrooms as the memories hugged her heels. Their footsteps echoed in the silence as if they were the first to walk the empty halls. For Amisha, however, the spirits of people filled the hollow space. She could hear the laughter of the students and the instructors who taught with sternness meant to mask an earnest desire to teach. Amisha ran her hands over the blackboards and erasers before leading them toward the door to the garden.
"Is this real?"
Ravi exclaimed when she opened the small door to the schoolyard.
"Paradise, my friend, in our small village."
Her sandals dug deep into the soft ground. Buried beneath the bloom of the flowers and alongside the roots of the trees were her memories of Stephen. Here, the ghosts did not haunt her, but beckoned, willing her to forget the sorrow of loss and rejoice in the thrill of having loved. She yearned to return to the time when she and Stephen were together, even though they stood separate. In their garden, they danced to silent music.
"I am not well, Ravi."
Amisha turned to him beneath the shade of her beech tree. The branches of the tree had sprouted over the sterile land. She stood against it and faced what she could not accept before.
"I need you to make a promise to me."
"Srimati,"
Ravi said, refusing to hear her.
"Listen to me,"
Amisha ordered. She feared the worst. Her body was enfeebled, and her mind tangled the days from the past with her present. The boys' names swam together, and Amisha could not differentiate their faces. She feared what she could not comprehend. Her body was alive, but her mind was withering.
"When I die, you must tell my daughter my story."
"Amisha, hush your words!"
Ravi used her given name for the first time. He had to convince her that nothing terrible would happen to her, that life was hers to live, and their friendship would always endure.
"Do not let the heavens hear you. They may take it upon themselves to believe you."
"The heavens have shown they have a dark hand, though the sun shines bright each day,"
Amisha cried.
"How can I believe I have a tomorrow, when today I feel so lost?"
Tears poured down her face.
"You will do more for me than any medicine, if you promise me. Please, Ravi,"
she begged, clasping her hands together.
"You have my promise, Srimati."
Ravi grabbed her hands and held them tight. She knew he would give her anything. All she had to do was ask.
"Thank you,"
Amisha said, her mind going blank.
"Ravi,"
her voice quavered. She leaned against the tree, desperate for the support it provided.
"Do you want me to send for the doctor?"
Ravi demanded.
"No."
She shook her head. It felt heavy, and no matter how hard she tried, the load would not lessen. She rubbed the skin above her skull and then began to pull at her hair, desperate to relieve the pressure. Her movements became frantic, and she succeeded in tearing a lump out.
"Stop, Srimati! Stop!"
Ravi tried to pull her hands away. She struggled against him, craving the pain of her hair loss to distract her from the agony.
"Get out!"
she cried, not seeing him. She tried to focus, to remember who Ravi was, but now he was a stranger. She struck his head and his stomach. She heard a cry, not realizing it was her own. She pounded harder and harder. She began to laugh, because something told her it was a game.
"I am writing a story," she said. "My children are playing."
Her three boys tossed a ball to her, and she smiled with joy because it was a glorious day, and the sun was shining, and everything was right.
"Stephen!"
Amisha reached out, and her arms embraced the air.
"You have a daughter?"
Amisha clapped her hands in joy. Her face moved from side to side as she searched for her boys and found them.
"Samir Jay, come, beta. Bring your brother."
Happiness shone on her face. "Stephen is here, and he will help me as he helped you, Ravi," Amisha said, her eyes unfocused. To Stephen, she whispered,
"I am so sorry for sending you away."
Then the throbbing began again, and her voice escaped her. She searched for her tongue with her hand, but the pressure was excruciating. Her eyes went blind, even as they remained open. Amisha tried to reach out, but her arms refused to move. She tried screaming to tell them something was wrong.
"Don't go!" she screamed.
But Stephen stepped back and took Lena with him. Her boys returned to playing, and soon they were out of sight. She tried to hold on to Ravi, but couldn't reach him. It was starting to get dark, and she was all alone. She fumbled for a branch, but the world continued to spin, and moments later, she fell beneath the shelter of her beech tree. Ravi, 48.
"The Brahmins say it is dark energy."
Deepak had just returned from a visit to the temple, where he spoke to the pujaris.
"Demons have entered her body and are playing with her mind."
The doctor had washed his hands of the case, telling Deepak that only God could help her now. Deepak's eyes darted to Amisha, who lay in a deep slumber. Her wrists and ankles were tied to the bed to keep her from hurting herself.
"They are coming to perform a ceremony. The children should not be here."
"Bina will take them to your sisters," Ravi said, his nerves taut.
Ravi and Bina shepherded the children out of the house and searched for a rickshaw.
"I'm not going," Samir said, as the other children watched.
Since Amisha had fallen ill, Samir had been the one who repeatedly checked on his mother.
"I will stay here."
His chin quivered.
"The Brahmins will help to heal her,"
Ravi tried to calm the boy, who had already seen so much. He had to fight to protect him from seeing any more. Refusing to tell him about the demons, he said,
"They will pray for her."
"Then I will pray with them."
Samir crossed his arms over his small chest. Ravi knew the child wanted the same thing he did, to help however he could. He grasped the young man's hand in his.
"God will listen to the prayers of Srimati's child more than anyone's. But your father has asked for the home to be empty so that the Brahmins can do their work. Please?"
As a child, Ravi was taught that death was a matter of time, neither to be feared nor fought. Life was a punishment, and the time spent on Earth an ordeal. For an untouchable, death provided relief from life's misery and a welcome return to oblivion. Ravi was unsure.